Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. This hour, 411 Teen talks common sense. Again, the common sense teen consists of teens with diverse political affiliations. The panel seeks to maintain a substantive political dialogue, analyzing and evaluating national, state, and local politics of today. Let's tap into the pulse of young folks. And remember, common sense may not always be common. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield, and joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome the team, and I'm always glad to have you, Hannah Kuros, 11th grade, computer science and diplomacy is her thing.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Olivia Saunders, she's also in the 11th grade, and she is into international politics and music.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Kian Bakmani, history and biology.
Hi, glad to be here.
And Shonda Dina Allen, and she is into chemistry and history. Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad to have you. Okay. Let's start here in Florida, though, before we go to the national scene. Here in Florida, the Orange and Osceola State Attorney, Aramis Aliana, is not willing to seek the death penalty. She took office in January after beating the incumbent, State Attorney Jeff Austin. In March, she announced that she would not seek death penalty for this high-profile case of Markeith Lloyd, and he was accused of murdering his pregnant ex-girlfriend and an Orlando police officer. And she says she's not going to seek the death penalty against anyone. Later, Governor Scott signed an executive order stripping her from the Lloyd case and reassigning the case. And he took 23 other first-degree murder cases from her. Most had already really been given the death penalty, and so consequently, they had been adjusted for their non-unanimous death sentences. You know, Florida changed their law so that if you got the death penalty, it would not be just 3-1. It would have to be, you know, everybody in agreement. So that is the kind of basis of this. The state attorney states that Scott is diluting the power of voters in Orange and Osceola counties, and taking cases away from her violates her constitutional right to due process. Prosecutors basically have kind of a wide discretion as to how they handle various cases. In this particular county, there were 62% of the people were against the death penalty, 31% were for. And I just wondered if you had any feelings or thoughts just about this particular case as you think about it. Yeah.
I think that even though I agree with Rick Scott, which I never thought I would say. I think that, I don't know, if your voters elect you to do something, then you should be allowed to do it. And I just have a lot of distrust of Rick Scott, and I think he'd do anything for his party to like him. So I think that, like, that he is calling her out, or that, not maybe not calling her out, but just that he's not respecting the vote of people in those counties is kind of shameless, and I don't really like it.
Okay. Other comments?
I think that what the prosecutor did and not wanting to consider the death penalty, I'm not saying that I don't know, like, the circumstances of the case, but the issue itself to me is that in the state of Florida, the death penalty is legal. Right. It is a part of the law, you know. I think that not being taking into consideration what you can fully do with the law and the full implications of what happened I think that you can't really just do that, you know? So, I mean, I don't know if you understand what I'm saying.
No, I understand well what you're saying.
Okay. So, basically, I think that what she did and not wanting to consider what she could do, I think that's what's wrong.
Okay. Just taking the death penalty totally off the table is what I hear you saying. Okay. Yeah. And she's saying, and before I get comments from you all, she's saying that the reason one of the things she's saying, she is taking the death penalty off the table is simply because, you know, it has a lot of problems. It's biased. It's discriminatory. How many people are on death row who later we find out are innocent? And she's not saying that they should not pay for their crimes. She's just saying that she's not comfortable doing the death penalty. Yes, ma'am.
I mean, I agree with that characterization of the death penalty. Mm-hmm. I think the amount of people that are exonerated while on death row is, like, really alarming.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the primary issue in this topic isn't whether the death penalty is, you know, morally reprehensible or not. I think it's, you know, whether counties are subservient to state laws. And I think it's funny because I know in the marijuana debate, states are legalizing something that's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it seems like she's trying to outlaw something that is legal. And I understand that there's, as you move up in like, or the organizations of government, there's like a very clear hierarchy. So I don't know how I feel because I guess if different counties are able to determine which laws they choose to follow and which laws they don't choose to follow, eventually I think rule of law will, like, collapse. And I think that's an extreme example.
Well, Another factor is you have to remember that these individuals, it was not unanimous, okay? And we now have a law that says for the death penalty to be levied on someone that it needs to be by unanimous decision. And so that's, I'm just saying what, you know, some of her retorts that she has shared. Yes, ma'am.
I don't know. To me, it's not a question of, like, whether or not she should consider the death penalty. Mm-hmm. It's whether or not she should exercise the powers that she's guaranteed. I agree that she should consider the death penalty as it is legal in Florida, but it's totally within her powers to not consider it.
Exactly.
As in, it's totally within her powers to choose which cases she takes or stuff like that. I mean, she just has a lot of free rein over what she can do. So I don't think what needs to be done is stripping her of that case. I think what needs to be done is going through a legal method to further define the powers of prosecutors. Mm-hmm. I think, like, this is an individual case, but if that's something that people feel very strongly about, then they should do a better job in the future to outline which powers prosecutors should have and which powers prosecutors shouldn't have, rather than, like, condemning a prosecutor for demonstrating those powers.
Shanda, did you have any comments?
Sure, it's covered it pretty well. in this case, she has the right to either consider or not consider it.
Right.
I don't really see why he came in and kind of interfered.
Well, her response and some of the comments has just been because he disagrees with her.
I mean, I personally don't like Rick Scott, so anything against him, like, I'm cool with. But I think she has the right to do whatever she needs to do, and maybe we need more kind of reasoning from him of, like, why did he make that decision?
I might be. Yeah, go for it. Oh,
I think if I'm understanding the case correctly, if she just hadn't made a blanket statement about the fact that she would never pursue the death penalty, then couldn't she have just continued to not seek the death penalty in the cases that she considered? That probably wouldn't have aroused as much
of attention.
No, that's
a good point.
And, like, she took a moral stance, which is admirable, even if it was inconvenient.
Mm-hmm.
But, I guess if Rick Scott stripping her of her ability to argue on the case because he disagreed with her personal politics and disagreed with the ruling that he knew she would seek seems... I think the separation of, you know, the courts and their ability to check the imposition of laws is like a big part of checks and balances. And we've seen that a lot in the Trump presidency. And it's cool that we're seeing this on the state level. So I think that's really important. And I think that the reason why this is such a big story is it seems as if Rick Scott is undermining that. Mm-hmm. And that's a scary thing.
Good point. Other comments? Well, we'll move to one more. We may not have time to finish it. But Facebook, you know, recently we had this fatal shooting of a Cleveland man. Facebook says that the fatal shooting video of the Cleveland man was online too long. It was online for 2 hours. First, the shooter announced his plans. In addition to his exploits, he had said that he had killed 13 people. He murdered 13 people. And lately, Facebook, the Facebook Live app, which is normally used for weddings and concerts and other events, has now been used for such violent acts as killing and rapes and suicide. And there, one of the concerns has been the fear that these postings would lead to copycat offenders trying to one-up the individual. And I just wondered what your position was on that. You know, in fact, the perpetrator, I think the police were in pursuit, and he stopped and ended up killing himself, mm-hmm. too.
What should it, is that an update today?
That is today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that just happened.
I guess I don't think you can really blame the Facebook Live app for mm-hmm. those that choose to abuse it, because they should be responsible for monitoring, you know, the people that are using their app to a certain extent. But obviously that crime is horrible, but I don't think you can blame Facebook Live. And if copycats do arise, then I don't think the app is culpable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
I think that in the future, Facebook Live just has to do a better job of, like, monitoring its use. I mean, he was someone who clearly said, like, this is what I'm going to do.
Yes.
Like,
that's a very good point.
And I believe it was a similar situation a couple months ago when those teenagers were caught, like, torturing a disabled person on Facebook mm-hmm. Live. Like, I believe it was mm-hmm. the same situation where they yeah. said, this is what we're going to do, and then Facebook Live did nothing to stop it.
I'm going to come back to you. You tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we were discussing the Facebook fatal shooting video of the Cleveland man. And you were talking, Olivia, and I had to interrupt you, so let me have you continue.
Yeah, basically what I was saying is just that I think that Facebook just has to do a lot better of a job of monitoring its content in real time. Like, I understand that not everything can be monitored, but if you're going to run an organ like that, I think that you should monitor it and take videos down and contact authorities where necessary. But I don't know. I like Facebook Live a lot. Like, a really cool thing that I saw the other day on Facebook Live was protests happening outside of Neil Dunn's office, and he, like, ran out his back door because he was trying to avoid protesters. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was so funny, and I never would have known about it if it weren't for Facebook Live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook Live, I mean, there's only been, like, a couple of really bad incidents like this. Mm-hmm. And for every bad one, there's, like, a million other good ones that happen. Right. Like, I can, like, listen to, you know, live concert or, like, ask questions for someone, like, if they're doing a discussion on Facebook Live. But I don't think there should be a reason to, like, take down Facebook Live or anything. It can be used, I mean, if you see something like this happen, it could also be used as an asset. Like, mm-hmm. all right, well, he says that this is going to happen, just call the police. Do something yeah. about it. Don't just sit there like, I can't do anything. No, mm-hmm. pick up the phone. I don't know how the process works with, like, monitoring the things, yeah. but they definitely need to kind of...
They could monitor, yeah, that's true.
I agree with everyone here. I think that abuse and exploitation and all that kind of stuff is kind of inevitable with a lot of things these days. And Facebook Live and other sites are no exception. And, yeah, I agree that there needs to be more monitoring or that kind of other kind of stuff. I also agree with Shauna that it can be an asset. But, yeah.
Do you think the copycat factor is important, is something that should be considered? Because we have found that a number of copycat behaviors have incited rapes, killings, whatever. Okay, and that's why they brought that up. I mean, how significant do you feel that the copycat factor is?
I think that it's just like with the internet, there's so much higher of a risk of it. Like, obviously, this isn't the same as like a rape or a killing, but you know, one post ends up on the internet, and then all of a sudden, all your friends are doing it. Like, it's not. I'd like to think that my friends would be smart enough to not commit a crime on Facebook Live. But yeah.
I mean, if you were going to commit the crime, why would you put it on Facebook?
Well, yeah, well, it's like you're kind of just asking to be caught. Mm-hmm. But I think that with the internet, there is this tendency to, like, just copy what other people are doing. And, yeah, I think, like someone said earlier, try to one-up the person that's doing it. So, yeah, I think that in addition to, like, being monitored, I think it also has to be, like, taken down immediately. And I think that...
And that someone was the initial complaint.
Someone needs to be made an example of, in some sense, like to let people know that these people are going to be prosecuted, and I think it needs to be public. But
that was the initial complaint, that it just stayed on too long. And the victim's grandson called in and said, you know, that is somebody that was loved. Will you please take this down? So you have that particular component to consider.
I think that Facebook could definitely do a better job with their monitoring, but I recognize that, like, I think there's so many people with Facebook accounts. There's so much content, and I think that's extremely overwhelming. And I don't even know, like, what sort of data centers they must be running to try to analyze and to catch, like, horrendous crimes that are committed on Facebook Live. So, yeah, I definitely think that monitoring should be implemented, and I think that I think that part of the problem is how much these acts are reported in the media, because even the video was up for maybe 2 hours.
2 hours.
Mm-hmm. But I've seen, like, 24-hour news cycle coverage of this.
Exactly.
And if you're someone that's, you know, mentally unstable, and if you're suicidal when you're viewing that, you're thinking, like, oh, wow, you know, I can die and make myself prolific, and it encourages the view that, like, if you I don't know, you kill yourself in a spectacular way, I don't know if you're going to achieve martyrdom, but people are going to hear your name. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that probably has a bigger role
impact.
In I think definitely more so than the fact that the video stayed on longer than some think it should have.
Yeah, so, like, these Facebook Live things, like, when I go to Facebook, they have, like, trending and things. And you have all these...
Yes.
It's a good medium to, like, get all this attention and get all this... just people to watch you. So I agree with Hannah. Like, putting this on Facebook is a... I guess it's a really sick and twisted way to kind of get attention. And people do tune in. Like, they did tune in. I don't know how to stop... Like, that's a personal thing. I don't know...
Indeed, and I think that's very valid, everything that you're saying. Okay. Well, we move on to national news. What's your assessment of the Trump presidency and the administration? We're not on television. Two bad people can't see you, Shonda. And the administration to this point.
In what aspect?
Just... overall, for example, let me just give you one. Trump now has denied or no longer allows a log of individuals who visit the White House. Okay? There's always been a log of when you visit the White House. Now, with Obama, Trump said that he had a faux transparency and that they would cross out some names, but he still had the log. Well, Trump is saying, no visitor log, because he doesn't need it and he doesn't want it. Does that strike you in any way? Does it?
I think, I don't know, I think that presidents make a lot of shady meetings behind our backs, whether or not it's written in the visitor log. Mm-hmm. The first thing I thought when you mentioned that was that we're studying the Cold War in history class right now, and it made me think of Richard Nixon, like something he would do. Mm-hmm. But regardless, I think that secret meetings have always occurred, and yeah, it's not great for transparency that Trump is doing this, but on the other hand, he is a media spectacle unto himself. Like, when he makes the important meetings, we kind of know. So, or at least thus far we've known. So,
we think we've known.
Hopefully. But regardless, everyone in his staff has had, like, a secret meeting with Putin at this point. So, I don't know that really. He could be meeting with, like, Kim Jong-un on a daily basis, and I wouldn't even be surprised at this point.
That would be surprising.
Yeah, it might
be. I don't know about you.
I think the this log incident is kind of really representative of the entire hypocrisy of his presidency so far. And, I mean, people point it out, but it just doesn't go through. Like, he doesn't, like, okay, golf is the really easy example. He complained so many times, Obama visits the golf course too much. But he's visited 18 times in this first, like, 100 days, which is more than a lot of presidents have. But and he's complained, and it's just, like, it doesn't resonate with him. He doesn't get it, you know? There's so many other incidences, and it's just, and with this lock thing, too, I think he was complaining about Obama not being transparent enough.
Right.
And now it's like, now there's no, now you have no access to any information. And I don't know, it's...
And that's when he was referring to Obama's faux transparency. Because even though Obama did have the law that you had to sign in, they did exercise the right to strike out names. So he said, hey, what's the difference? Is there a difference? Yeah, go right ahead.
I think that faux transparency is a lot more admirable than no transparency, because if you're at least feigning transparency, then you think it's worthwhile and you think that it's something that you should, like, attempt to achieve. So, I think it's fairly ridiculous, but as far as, you know, all of the ridiculous things that Donald Trump has done, I think it, like, ranks pretty low on the scale. Mm-hmm. And I think the more important things that he's done within the past week have been, like, foreign policy related, and especially it's the first time the U.S. has, like, administered a military strike not on members of ISIS but on the Assad regime itself, and I think that that's, like, way more significant. And sometimes I think, you know, if you go into the minutiae of, like, all of the strange and, like, not awful but just, like, kind of, like, off-kilter things that the Trump presidency is going to, like, end up generating, then you lose sight of the big picture.
The big picture, that's right.
And I feel like this week, like, Syria, China, North Korea are big picture, logbook, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly entitled to your opinion. I'm just looking at all the things that have happened, and some are feeling that this logbook is indicative of other things to come.
Yeah.
And it's representative of... And you said it excellently, Shauna, but of the hypocrisy, okay? It's easy for him to make these dictates and comments on what folks do, but he should not have any criticism. He should be able to decide and do and behave in any manner, and that's where the hypocrisy comes. I think you've seen that. And I agree. How'd you feel about him dropping the bomb, so to speak? What was your comments? I mean, you brought that up. That's a good, very good point.
Which bomb?
Which one?
Joab on Afghanistan? Oh, that's such a scary question.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, and another question is, are we getting ready to go to war? I mean, if you look at everything, what do you think? Everybody's like, oh, Lord.
I saw somewhere, actually, that about the Moabs and the mother of all bombs.
Mm-hmm.
They were like 20 made in 2003, and we've used one to date.
Right.
And it was shelf life of 15 years, so he's got a year left to use all of our 19 left of them.
Maybe.
But with the strikes against the Assad regime, Trump did what Obama said he would do but didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Obama drew a red line with the Assad regime that they should never use chemical weapons. Or else it prompt U.S. intervention. And then when the Assad regime did use chemical weapons, I believe in a suburb of Damascus, I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that.
I think that's it.
The Obama administration reached a deal with Russia brokering it that they would – the U.S. wouldn't do anything with the Assad regime as long as they promised never to use chemical weapons again. And now that Obama's gone and they used the chemical weapons, which I totally disagree with, in Idlib and Trump – I think rightfully, even though I support Assad and don't like Trump, attacked the Syrian air base in central Syria and, like, I think destroyed, like, a good portion of the functional Syrian air force. I think that that's a move in the right direction. I mean, like, I think that's the end of the right direction. but I think that you have to let the Assad regime know that, you know, chemical weapons aren't right and that's not something they should be doing. But at the same time, like, Trump is, like, showing that, you know, U.S. is all this, you know. We can do what we want and all that. But I think anything further than what has happened is kind of a mistake to make, especially considering that Russia is in the region and militarily active. And then with the bomb in Afghanistan, that was also successful because it killed. I think the death count was near 100 last time I saw.
Yes, it was.
And it was all militants, which is a good thing, because if it was civilians, you know, it could be used as propaganda and all that kind of stuff. But it kind of shows that the Trump administration is going to be more active than Obama's was in the region.
Okay. Comments?
So over the week, I had this, like, I had a very different thinking process of, like, the entire course of events and, like, bomb droppings. And my first thought when I saw the Syria bombing was, yeah, man, we stuck it to Russia. Like, on one hand, I think that it's really bad to, like, use human casualties to, like, stick it to Russia. And we shouldn't do that. But I think that it's just – it made Russia mad. And I was really happy about that. And I really very strongly dislike our president, and I was very impressed with him that he chose to do something that wasn't supported by the guy that's kind of been his ally this whole time. So I thought that it was really good that he kind of struck a little bit more independence from Russia and basically said this, like, my assumption was that the administration was going to do whatever Russia wanted it to do, and he kind of proved me wrong in, like, the good kind of way. I definitely agree with Keon. I think, like, it was good that Trump took that next step that Obama never took. And I also – I thought it was – I don't see it boiling over into another conflict just because I think that it was, like, a one-time thing, and I think that everyone who looks at it knows it, and that's why Russia hasn't retaliated. But even so, I think that – I think it was a good show of power in the region. But then when he dropped – the bomb in Afghanistan, I wasn't so pleased because the first time I thought it was like, ooh, long-term strategy, strategic move, you go. But then the second time I was like, I don't know about that because it didn't really seem to have a long-term strategy or like a rhyme or reason. He just seemed to kind of do it. And it's true that the bomb was successful, but like – we can't afford to do that everywhere that there's ISIS militants. Like, you know, I think that there has to be some sort of, like, long-term strategy of what's going to happen in the region. Otherwise, we're just going to end up, like, destabilizing it more. And then in turn, that's going to destabilize us more. So that was a little bit frightening to me. And I also, like, we've tried to invade Afghanistan so much. Why are we trying again? But,
Sorry. I kind of wanted to disagree about the Afghanistan part. I think that the strike in Afghanistan was on an ISIS, like, headquarters or something in Nahangar province, and that's like the ISIS stronghold in Afghanistan. I think that personally, I'm of the opinion that U.S. intervention in Afghanistan is not necessarily a bad thing. I think it's, I mean, it should have been, I think it's ineffectual, and that it could have definitely worked out better under Obama and under, yeah, but I think that, because the Afghan government, it's kind of like, it's not where it used to be. It's getting better now and all that, but at the same time, they need a lot of the guidance that America can support, although, like, we haven't, like, been great with it, and it's hard to work with the Afghan government because it's corrupt and all that kind of stuff, or at least the local governments. I think that with the strike against just militants, I don't believe there should be a huge U.S. military presence. I don't think there should be huge bombing strikes. But I think that in this case, that it strategically, you know, eliminated a bunch of ISIS fighters. That's demoralizing first to them. It cripples their ability to, you know, retaliate and all that, because that was one of their bases. I think that in this case, the opportunity he took was hit or miss, and he hit. So I don't think that, like, you know, they should be ramped up and, like, continue, like, you know, I don't think there should be escalation, especially not in Syria. That would be a mistake, especially.
You're tuned in to 411 Team. We're going to take a break, and we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and we are going to go to Hannah Kiros. I know you had some comments you wanted to share.
Thanks. But, I guess I also agree with Kian that I think that the dropping of the Moab in Afghanistan was a positive development, mm-hmm. because... this is my civilian opinion, so I guess I don't know a lot about, like, the minutiae of the military tactics that we're implementing against ISIS, but I personally think that military actions against ISIS have to be coordinated with efforts that are attempting to delegitimize, you know, the caliphate they're trying to establish in Syria, and take aim at the ideology of the organization so that it can, you know, discourage recruitment. And a lot of the time when we're attempting to kill ISIS fighters, we end up hurting civilians. And I think the fact that no civilian casualties were amassed during this attack is, like, a huge plus. So I think it was executed effectively. Also, the Moab is the top-level weapon you can get in Bloons Tower Defense 3. So I thought it was very funny that it came up. And I guess in Syria, I definitely don't support the Assad regime, but in the Syrian civil war, I don't really support anyone because I know Assad actively supports the release of jihadists into Syria because he knows that they're likely to join the rebel forces so that they can be delegitimized, and that means that nations are less likely to support the Syrian rebels. But I think that I guess the people that I support in the Syrian civil war are the Syrian civilians who end up basically, like, having to deal with the brunt of the casualties that are wrought by both sides. But I'm kind of – I think we're learning about the Cold War right now in U.S. history, and the U.S. is supporting I think we're going to end up supporting the rebels, I think. But the Russian government is, like, very strongly supporting Assad, and it seems as if the Syrian civil war is, in, like, certain extent, it's leaning towards a proxy war, which is, like, I think the Syrian civil war as it is now is chaos, and I think that if two global superpowers end up getting involved, it'll just become more chaotic, and I think our president is not well equipped to deal with that chaos. And I know with the Moab strike, a general administered that without his approval, which he didn't need. So that's not like a knock on the general. No. But the world is scary. And the Middle East is still a hotbed. And it's with the way that Donald Trump has, like, you know, handled these crises, even though they've gone well, his level of comprehension on what's actually going on seems to be very low, and I find that pretty frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, his administration—they're very—they want action, which is good, but I feel like you have to have like an equal amount of diplomacy. He's not very diplomacy heavy. I don't know if he thinks that it's because it's hard or because action is more effective, I guess. But so with these two. I think it's either hit or miss, like you said. And that's kind of 50-50. And I think we got very lucky with these two. And I don't think that in the long run, this is not going to work. We can't just bomb our enemies.
Where do we stop, or when do we stop, or do we stop policing the world?
I think that I don't agree with the extent to how we're policing it now, but I think Syria was different because that was like just a flagrant violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions, which like with I think to me that it violates the Geneva Conventions is very significant, just in the sense that like the Geneva Conventions lay out the laws for all warfare in the world. And if we break the Geneva Conventions, then we are essentially opening up the world to types of warfare which could, you know, unleash mass destruction on countries all over the world, not just in Syria. So I think that attacking after a chemical weapons attack is, like, very crucial to the sense of, like, setting a precedent and saying that this is unacceptable.
I want to say that I agree with you on that, but at the same time, the Geneva Conventions isn't really a limiting factor for the United States because, like, America is allies with, like, Israel, right? And they break a whole lot of Geneva Conventions. I think that it's a whole lot more a matter of, opportunity, as opposed to what's right and what's wrong. And I think that where an opportunity arises, that America is willing to take, you know.
I agree with Kian that our foreign policy is really opportunistic, and especially with the first and second immigration bans, there was like a very prominent ban missing in Saudi Arabia, which is a majority Muslim nation that we have very strong business ties with. So, and even like in the case of the Rwandan genocide, the U.S. tends to ignore crises that are occurring where they can't seek a very like clear moral high ground, or it's either that wouldn't be as easily marketable to the U.S. general public, or just wouldn't be profitable for them to intervene. And so I think the U.S. is on the whole like a benevolent force. I think that we do a lot of good in the world, but like we don't intervene unilaterally. You know,
I also though I think that you said it yourself. Marketing to the general public plays a huge role. Obviously, there are people that want to get involved in foreign conflicts, but there's a large group of people in this country that don't want to get involved with foreign conflicts. I mean, that's why, like, my uncle is a veteran of Vietnam. He supported Obama when he was an Illinois senator because he wanted to pull out of Iraq. And that was why a lot of people supported him. And the issue with Rwanda was that, like, that there was no public support behind it. Whereas, like, with Bosnia, we saw the massive destruction that occurred in Rwanda, and the American public was more willing to support a war against genocide after seeing all the destruction in Rwanda. So I think that it is very, like, time-dependent, and, like, I definitely agree that we should strive to incorporate morals and international law into our foreign policy, but I think that, I don't know, public opinion is also something that's really important that we should consider, and I think that it will continue to be consideration, maybe not for the Trump presidency, because I absolutely agree with you on Saudi Arabia, but
we look for opportunity. Like, I agree with everything you've said, and we don't really do anything if it doesn't make us look good in front of the world. And I think it's good that we do reflect the people's opinion. Like the if sometimes I want to do things differently, but if the but we can because majority people like we don't. It's not represented well. It's, our country's right. not. But
and also I, because of our political ties, I think we're very much influenced by that.
Sometimes it would be nice if we could disregard them, but that's not how it works. I think if you kind of stray away from that, then everything else is going to start collapsing.
I agree with Jordan. I think that there's a really hard balance that you have to strike, as you know, any figure in a government or as a government body yourself, when you're trying to balance like being a benevolent force for like good in the world, and you know, doing well by your country and making sure that you're looking out for your national self-interest. And so, like, I guess we can't expect the U.S. to get involved in every foreign conflict because, it's like, in North Korea, what are we going to do? Like, there's certain, you have to respect the sovereignty of the nations that you're dealing with. But I guess to speak to the marketability, I know as an Ethiopian, in the 1990s, there was, like, a lot of press coverage of the famine in Ethiopia. And I think in the long term, I think that's been a little bit detrimental to Ethiopia's economic opportunities and the people that are willing to invest in Ethiopia because it's hard to move past that image. But especially at the time, aid that was like very crucial to Ethiopia ended up being delivered. And even though, you know, a horrible famine still occurred, a lot of that was alleviated by U.S. foreign aid. So the U.S. has done like wonderful things as a part of their you know, their foreign policy. And I know the International Rescue Committee and the International, like, Institute for Peace, they there's, like, really, really good organizations in the U.S. that are doing really great work. And even if that's selective, I feel like we still have to commend the U.S. for at least adhering to the belief that, like, other parts of the world matter and we should attempt to alleviate suffering when we can.
Okay. Other comments? Well, we've got to talk about taxes.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking at them. We have to address taxes because taxes are in the forefront. And as you all know, Trump has not released his taxes. He states that he's still, you know, being audited. Now, he said that for the 2015, and it's 2016. And what's your position on his releasing his taxes? What is he trying to hide? Is he trying to hide anything? How do you read it? What do you think is going on with his refusal and multiple excuses for not releasing his taxes? And this hasn't happened, I may add, in, 40 years that we've had a problem with the president releasing his taxes. He said when he was campaigning he would release them. It still hasn't happened. Does it matter to you? Do you think it's important?
I think that the issue is that you're getting a president who is heavily invested in private business, and he himself, you know, has like a business empire, right? And with every big business, even small businesses in this country, there's going to be tax fraud. I mean, people lie about their taxes all the time. I mean, they lie about what they buy, lie about rent, all that kind of stuff, so they can get
well, the system is set up.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, yeah. But I think it should definitely have been expected. I think the fact that he won't release them just, you know, assures the fact that he is lying on the tax return or whatever he got on his taxes. And I don't think it matters what his taxes actually – I mean, he's lying about it. It's fraudulent. I think that it should definitely be expected. And I think that if you get hung up on this too long, like if you honestly like expect him to be someone – I think that if you expect so much out of him that he's not lying, I think – the baseline is he's lying. It doesn't matter how much he lied about. So, like, I think at the same time you should know this and not – I mean, you should – I mean, not saying, like, he's a great person, but you should, like, leave that out of the equation of him being a good president, a good or a bad president. Because, I mean, it's going –
it's going to happen. You said
yeah.
That's inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's just a part of it. Yeah.
That made me think of after, you know, Bill Clinton's presidency, people were like, they, you know, there was a like a very large scandal when people realized that he cheated on his wife. But there, I think his presidency, like as of now, is viewed as being like a pretty great time for the economy, and you know, the late 1990s were just like, you know, a pretty decent time for most Americans, so people were willing to overlook his personal failures for what he did for the country. But in this case, I think it's pretty scary to say that, like, holding the president to the standard that he will tell the truth is, like, unreasonable and that we should get rid of that. And I get, I don't think that's what you were trying to say. I think you were, I mean, what I got from it is that you can't get hung up on small details like this, which, and even though they only impact, like, a single person, well, no, what the president does impacts everyone.
Okay.
But the president's foreign policy and the domestic policies that he implements can affect, you know, the entire world. Yeah. So I think you, like, obviously, he has so many skeletons in his closet. And, like, the fact that you're not releasing your tax returns, even though that implies that something bad is happening, I've been in a position where it's better to, like, look a little bit shady rather than people find out what you're actually doing. So, which makes me sound like a very shadowy character. But, like, you know that he obviously has very fundamental personal issues and probably business conflicts that would inhibit any normal president. And you should recognize that. You should continue to criticize that, but while keeping that in mind, like, again, keep the bigger picture of what his presidency will do after he's gone, and like what his different policies could potentially do to, like, I don't know, the world on a global scale.
Okay. What do you think, Libby? Is it important?
I just don't care at this point. I know he's a liar. I know he's done illegal stuff. It's just not important to me at this point. I feel like we have. If we're going to remain vigilant, we can't remain vigilant about his tax returns of all things. Like, it's just not important to me. I mean, well, obviously it sucks, but I'm not going to call Donald Trump and persuade him to release his tax returns.
But it stays in the news, and that's exactly why we're addressing it.
Yeah.
Just to see, what do you all think? Is it?
It's just not even surprising at this point, and I understand that people are, like, really upset, like, marching to release his tax returns, but, you know, because we all know he listens to protests, you know, like, I just think it's useless at this point, and I would rather focus on analyzing his domestic and foreign policy than focus on, like, him as a person, because I already know I don't like him as a person.
It's been recurring for a long time, and it was silent for a while, and I don't know, I think it, like, picked up last weekend. I was like, oh, yeah, I mean, what's new? Like, he does all, like, I don't care. Like, he's done so many, honestly, I commend the Trump supporters if you still support him.
That's dedication.
I wouldn't.
Well, another question. How do you feel, and we have a couple minutes, so maybe we can address it. How do you feel about the increased involvement of his family members in the government?
You know, from an ideological standpoint, I don't like it, but Jared and Ivanka have done things that I've liked.
Yeah.
So, like, Bannon's out.
Yeah.
He didn't sign a thing about discrimination on gay people. So, like, at this point, I'm just not going to complain because he's done things that I think make him more of a rational president. Because, you know, having Steve Bannon on your cabinet is probably not the brightest idea.
So do you think Bannon is really out?
I hope so. I hope he's gone forever.
Question.
I hope he's just, like, not in politics, but that's not going to happen.
No.
So,
okay, yeah.
Oh, I think seeing all of the family, like, in the White House together, it seems a little bit monarchical, and that's, like, a little bit freaky. But, I mean, yeah, I guess I think that Ivanka and her husband have some sense. And I think that a lot of the time she's able to keep her dad in check. So, there should be other people that you're willing to listen to that aren't your daughter. So the fact that she has to be the one to hold you, like, accountable is slightly ridiculous. And, like, it's contrary to the idea of American democracy that your family's so deeply entrenched in politics. But I think the net result, at least, like, not in the long term, in the short term, has been, like, pretty good.
I'm happy.
20 seconds.
I'm happy that there's at least one person that can control Trump, but at the same time, it's made me angry because there are other people who have worked all their life to kind of achieve something that Ivanka has just been born into.
Well, I appreciate it. We don't have time, but to my listening audience, thank you for the privilege of your ear and time. That's it for this edition of 411 Teen. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistant, Ken Smith. Audio copies are available, and if you want to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org. Check us out on Facebook.